Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and we are here for the first episode of the season of The Sound of Economics live series to comment on the State of the Union speech delivered just a few hours ago, this morning, 16 September 2020, by the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen. I'm here with Guntram Wolf, the director of Bruegel, and the senior fellows Alicia Garcia Herrero and André Sapir. Hello to all of you.
Hello.
Hello.
So I would like to thanks for joining in this discussion, and I would also like to thank our listeners to joining in and tuning in for this live session of the podcast. And I would like to remind that you can also join our conversation by asking questions on Slido using the hashtag Soteu, S-O-T-E-U. So, without no further ado, I would like to introduce what we have just been listening a few hours ago from the hemicycle of the European Parliament, which actually was an almost empty and socially distant hemicycle due to the COVID-19 prevention measures. And this was one of the longest State of the Union speeches ever, probably the longest, and it lasted for around an hour and a half. So I will try to give a few pointers and few highlights of the different sections in order to frame what we've been listening. So first of all, we heard the president reminding the state we are in and the pandemic, and she used that to make a plea for a stronger health union, revising the health competencies, suggesting to revise the health competencies at the Conference for the Future of the EU, and also announcing a global health summit hosted by the EU in Italy next year during their G20 presidentship. Plus, she made quite a lot of points on the initiatives of the European Union on the vaccine. Then she went on workers, and she made an announcement about a proposal for a European framework for minimum wages. And then she announced new emission targets. She said that the EU should be reducing emissions of 55% by 2030, and she also spent some time discussing green bonds. She said that the Commission will raise at least 30% of its 750 billions borrowing for the recovery fund in the form of green bonds. We are probably going to discuss this in a minute later. She went on for a section on a stronger monetary union, mentioning the historical agreement on the next generation EU and the principle of balancing support to the fiscal sustainability. Given the fragility of the economy, she recalled the 12% drop of GDP in the second quarter and the ongoing uncertainty of the pandemic and the economic outcast. But leader for the details, she detailed on own resources and the recovery fund beside the green bonds mentioned earlier. She also dedicated quite a section on industrial strategy and especially on digital. She has been announcing a common plan for digital Europe, where there should be defined goals for 2030, such as connectivity, skills, and digital public services. And this should represent 20% of the next generation EU. Then she went on a strong section on geopolitics and the role of EU in the world. There was a strong reference to China. There was a reference to the United States, Brexit, Belarus, Russia, and Turkey. And within that frame, she also mentioned migration, announcing the upcoming pact on migration. And then she ended the speech with a section on rule of law, covering issues from corruption to money laundering to fundamental freedoms. So this seems to me quite the catalogue of the different things that she has been mentioning in the speech. I might, of course, be missing some details, but the idea was to recall all the plethora of things that were mentioned in this an hour and a half speech. And in order to start the discussion, I would like to ask to you, Guntram, André, and Alicia, what actually is your overall feeling? What is your overall and main takeaway from this speech before we are going to dive a little bit more into the details of some of these sections that I was mentioning just before?
Well, thank you, Giuseppe, and let me perhaps start. I mean, I think this is always an important speech for the European Commission president, because it sort of tries to pull together the entire agenda that's on the plate of the Commission and the European Union in really one speech. And this time, perhaps it has been so long because there are so many more issues than usual. So it is a difficult speech, and I have to say, it's a speech that is always very presidential. And if you ask me, for my taste, it was a little bit perhaps too presidential. So a little bit too much about big announcements and a little bit not concrete enough on sort of the real issues and how to achieve those issues. You know, I mean, just to give you a sense of what I mean. I mean, I think, for example, the discussion on green. I mean, I would have wished to have a bit more concrete announcements on you know, how to get to the new climate goals. Or if we take the discussion on the pandemic and the recovery fund, I would have wished the Commission president to strengthen the negotiating hand of the European Parliament and, you know, to make some announcement that the European Parliament should actually have a say on how the money is spent and, you know, should have a way of flagging that money is not well spent. And so I think overall my feeling was, and I don't want to be too long, my feeling was it was a tick too presidential. It's always presidential, but it was a tick too presidential. And I feel many citizens might feel that it's actually very difficult to relate to this speech, which is never easy. But I felt this time it was perhaps a bit too presidential.
André, was it too presidential for you?
So, yes, it was presidential, but no, it was not too presidential. I think it was presidential at the right level, and you know the way we judge what is right or too little or too much is according to our expectation. My expectation was something of that level. It is a speech of the president, after all, inspired by, you know, the speeches by similar speeches by U.S. presidents. Was sort of at the same time examining what has happened during the last year and where we are moving to. Sort of it's giving the broad direction of where we have traveled from and where we are planning to travel from. And then it's normal to me that it doesn't give the details. It's just sort of, you know, gives the road without giving all of the elements. Sure, there are bumps on the road and, you know, there are all kinds of elements on the road, and you may drive in different cars on this road. But I think here the idea is to give a sense of what are our priorities. And, you know, the way I personally do this is by looking at the text and looking at words and how many times are words repeated. And I think, Giuseppe, you picked up on, you know, on exactly those words that you heard a lot. Yes, next generation EU, which was, after all, a big achievement of the European Union, that is cited many, many times, sort of this notion of pulling through together, an important message for Europe of solidarity and moving together. Yes, when you look forward, the two key issues are indeed digital, quoted 18 times, and green, cited sort of equally green and climate. So those are the two flagship policies. And then indeed an important discussion about Europe and the neighborhood and Europe and the wider world. And I think everything was there. Not too much, not too little. I think it's addressing headlines in newspapers all over the world. You know, what is Europe achieving and what is Europe trying to achieve in the coming months? So to me, it was the right tone and it said all the right things. Then obviously we will have to judge in a year, you know, how much of this road has been traveled. But I think the road that she's designing is the right.
Alicia, you have a special observatory being in Asia, and actually we can see from the screen that it's evening already and dark already over there. What was your impression from that side of the world?
Thank you, Giuseppe. Frankly speaking, it's the very first time I listened to the whole speech, and it happens to be the longest. And it is very different when you actually go by word for a speech of this nature. And I want to refer to what Guntram said about the, yes, presidential. I agree with Andre, it has to be presidential. But at the same time, how close to the citizens it was. And I actually think that President van der Leyen tried very hard to be close to the citizens with a number of touchy concepts. I can give you a few, like we have valued wealth rather than well-being. We need to move from fragility to vitality. We need to turn fear into cooperation. We are a social market economy. And a human economy with which should protect us. You know, frankly speaking, I mean, it's very, the attempt to touch everybody's heart is there. But if you ask me, as an economist, I'm like, is this a socialist state? Or, I mean, you know, like, I feel it's too many times repeating the concept of protection. This is a pandemic. You may be okay protecting yourself from a pandemic, but you know we need to also think about competitiveness, moving ahead. You know, I just felt that the balance between the two was too much towards the social aspects, which of course can be justified by the pandemic, but lead us to feel that the European Union is there just to protect us. But nobody can protect us, not even the European Union. That, to me, telling citizens, you know what? We need to change for the sake of competing in this very difficult world, surviving the new, you know, forces. We're between two hegemons. We need to be there. I mean, that thing, to me, was missing. So it was a very good attempt, I mean, an attempt, I'm not sure how good, but an attempt to reach the citizen with things the citizen can understand. But I'm not sure we're really doing any favor to the citizens to kind of deny the reality out there. That's really my point. It's too protectionist for what I think Europe should be heading towards. And that's really the key thing I wanted to say.
Alicia, thank you for your remarks. I think that we are going to go a bit more in depth into some of those remarks when you speak about this protectionist approach. I will be curious in a second when we are going to speak about the geopolitical aspect, especially vis-a-vis the global player and the positions that were outlined in the speech. How this protectionist versus the openness has been playing out. But one of the first follow-up of a main points over there of the speech was the green side. I mean, green and digital were these two big bats word that also André has been mentioning, and where indeed issues related to what you're saying, Alicia, related to competitiveness on one side and protection on the other side, we're all at play. I mean, they can be traced within that. So maybe it will be interesting to go a bit deeper into first these two issues. First, the green one. There has been this announcement of the new targets for the reduction of the emissions to 55% for 2030. And the first question is to you: is what do we make out of this? Are those targets first of all achievable? Are they realistic? And then secondly, obviously, this was a broad speech, so it didn't went into the details of how those things will be achieved. But what do we make out of it? What can we expect on this area?
We all agree, certainly at Bruegel, but I think most citizens by now agree that climate change is a reality, and is a reality that is deeply affecting all of us and is affecting our planet. And I think we are understanding that climate change needs to be tackled. I mean, this is the biggest challenge of humanity. And I think in that sense, I think I certainly endorse the idea of becoming climate neutral as fast as possible. And I think the 55% goal, announcing such a goal, is very ambitious. To achieve it, I would like to see how we achieve it. And the Commission will, of course, publish tomorrow on Thursday, the 17th of September. It will publish an economic assessment of how this will be done. And we will have to study that assessment in some detail. For my taste, if I look at what was there in the speech, I thought what was missing was an acknowledgement that this is not an easy thing to achieve at all. I mean, this is going to be a huge challenge. It's not just as the Commission would like us to believe, a golden opportunity and even a growth strategy. I mean, the Commission likes to call the climate strategy a growth strategy. No, I mean, in the beginning, it means, if we are serious about it, it means, stopping polluting industries, stopping polluting cars. It means, as an economist, I would say, it means debt weight loss, or it means basically stranded assets, right? So this is a cost to our society for sure in the short term. And I think what most citizens worry about is, well, now we are here, 12% GDP is 12% down. I'm about to lose my job, or I risk losing my job. And by the way, I might have to commute 500 kilometers to get to my new job, or 200 kilometers. And now the Commission is going to, impose a big tax on my car, and it's going to make it impossible for me to actually find a new job. I mean, that's what citizens worry about. And, I think she would have done herself, a favor, acknowledging that fighting climate change, yes, it is a priority. Yes, it's the right priority to pursue. But yes, it's going to be difficult. And yes, we will have to invest into invest a lot into alternatives. We will have to support workers that might lose their job because of it. We will have to find ways of really making this socially feasible. And I think she should have said that more clearly.
Alicia, what do you think?
Well, I think first of all, I fully agree with Guntram that putting those targets out there with, in the light of the pandemic sounds like nothing changed because of the pandemic kind of question. If you're a citizen, it's like, wait a minute, what are our priorities? What comes first? What comes next? And I think that is indeed missing. I also think that the new target, or at least new to me, the 30% financing green green bond financing for the 75 750 billion recovery fund seems to put the balance in something that, in my mind, is easier, how to finance that thing. We use green bonds. Why not? It's a new market. You know, European banks will love it. Rather than how much shall we spend out of the 750 billion in climate change oriented strategies. So if I were reading that part, you know, as somebody interested in those industries, I would have wanted to know what was ultimately the arrangement, because we all know that there was a lot of fighting, infighting. By the way, from the speech, it sounded we all agreed with this recovery fund, but we all know that it was hard. Maybe she could have acknowledged that, you know, in the last approved deal, there was a little bit of a compromise on this very important issue. But nothing was said, maybe to avoid that sad news that, you know, we kind of cut a little bit on what was very important, according to her speech. So that it was a little bit unbalanced, in my opinion. If this is so important, why didn't we have more funds for it? And whether you finance it with green bonds will make a difference to the environment, let me tell you, because we all know that, you know, it's a very, very broad definition of what is actually considered a green bond. So it's not very convincing to me. That's what I mean to say, yeah.
André?
So I would say that, what she said is sort of general nature, not in details, but as Guntram said, that the details, they will come in the documents that will be published in the coming days. So I think that is fine. 5%. I think that was interesting. After all, she had already in her speech to the European Parliament when she was appointed as president, and it was confirmed by Parliament as for the presidency of the European Commission, she had already indicated then that she was thinking about getting into this objective, this stricter objective of 55%. And so I thought that this was very good, because she does say in a speech that, in a sense, she has been discussing this with a number of economic actors, and that she has the support for this more ambitious target. So I think she did the right thing. She flagged it a year ago. Then she spent some of her time to sort of try to get a feel of how the economic actors would react to this. And then, you know, she decided, no, let's go and, you know, let's make proposals that indeed would make this more binding. Now, obviously, it is ambitious, and it will have all kinds of consequences, some of which Guntram alluded to. But again, I think, you know, we should not give the message to citizens that simply achieving climate neutrality by 2050 is going to happen in 2049. In order to meet the zero net emission in 2050, this is going to be a very demanding road. And if we want to reach that objective in 2050, we better set ourselves a number of milestones. And I think to set the milestones for 2030 is what needs to be done. Otherwise, we will never reach the point. We will always delay, you know, reaching, you know, as I said, it's in 2049 that suddenly we are going to do all of the job, and we know that doesn't make any sense to. So I think she's bringing a sense of realism of what this means. Now, how this will be translated. And again, this will be done differently in different countries. I mean, the Commission is not going to set precise targets for each individual country. That is countries that we need to say, hey, this is the way we are going to meet the target that we have in common. And different countries will do it differently. Those that use coal, well, they won't have to do the same thing as those that use the nuclear power. So there will be a variety of approaches, and those variety of approaches, they will come from the member states. I think her job and the job of the Commission is again to set the road and to set the objective. So to put the objective at 55% reduction by 2030 and confirming that, that leaves 10 years. I think it's sufficient time, but it will be certainly a hard road to travel. But we will need to we will need to do it at some stage, so we may as well be ambitious right now. So I think, again, I think the tone that she used and the target that she set is the right one in my mind.
I wanted to go back to what both Alicia and Guntram have said at the beginning of the discussion around the green and the emissions and the change of the economy, because to me there is and there was not only in the speech but in general there is this attachment between or like link between the narrative that is being sold by saying this is a big opportunity for growth when it comes to the, let's say, the green revolution or however we want to call it, together with the digital side. The two things somehow are never disconnected from the narrative that the Commission is trying to portray in terms of what is going to be the new industrial strategy or the new industrial future of Europe. So I think that we cannot complete our overview of what she was saying in the speech when it comes to the green side without looking at what she said on the digital part. And there, I'm really curious to understand what you thought out of it, because she dedicated quite a lot of time to speak about digital and even about broadband access and so on. But then how do we make her part of the speech on digital, you know, comparing to the part of the green, and how do we relate these two things with each other when it comes to the strategy?
On the ability of Europe to be a player in developing new technologies, this is where I think is the biggest challenge for us, because Europe is really lagging behind and for a very, very long time, especially vis-a-vis the United States and China. I think that is where Europe needs to set itself sort of very clear, very ambitious targets. She did come out with a number, which is that Europe will commit an investment of 8 billion euros for the next generation of supercomputers. Okay, that's something clear. Whether that is sufficient, that is a different matter. So I think we will need indeed, and you know, she's not the first president. Juncker, even Barroso, obviously talked a lot about digital, and our gap has not decreased vis-a-vis the US and China in this space. So I think there it is very important for a variety of issues, including green. And yes, I think that we need to be more ambitious. And I wish that there she did not only say the word digital, but she was more clear into the fact that we are really lagging behind and that we need to make a huge effort.
Thank you. Guntram or Alicia, do you want to add something on the digital side?
Well, I mean, if I can just add very quickly, I mean, I entirely agree that, you know, the climate targets, it's good that she announced them, and achieving the climate targets, of course, also requires beefing up our digital strategy. And I thought she was right, the president, Commission president was right to really spend a lot of time, quite some time on the digital issues that we are facing. But as André says, I mean, it's not the first time that this was mentioned by a previous Commission president. And there are clear issues why we are lacking behind. And my sense is, if I read this and I reread this part of the speech, I mean, I think on for example, on the issue of artificial intelligence, she spent a lot of time talking about how to regulate it. She spent almost no time talking about how we can adopt it quickly, and you know why we do not, why we are not a leader in this. I mean, we are neither a leader in development, on the machine learning algorithms. I mean, we have some top scientists there, but in sort of applying those and then turning it into commercial opportunities, we are just not a leader. I mean, it's as simple as that. And she didn't spend any time on that. And then, you know, then the, of course, the rollout of broadband and all of that. I mean, sure. I mean, we all agree with that. But it's been a pity that so far we haven't been able to do it in the rural regions, right? And it now haunts us, including in this pandemic, that we haven't done the rollout of broadband to the extent we should have done. And, you know, that has concretely to do with the way we regulate and we have dealt with our telecommunication companies. And it has many, many concrete reasons, right, why we are there. And so just sort of saying, well, we will now do it, I think is not enough to a skeptical observer, at least. So overall, yes, I think on the digital, it is right that we have to accelerate. And I think the commission president, it's important that she reinforces that message. I mean, we cannot afford, you know, just business as usual on the digital side. We need to have a step up our efforts massively, both on sort of cutting edge technology, but I would also say really on applying existing technologies such as machine learning algorithms and, you know, turning them into commercial opportunities. And, you know, really, that's not just about regulation. On the contrary, it's also about investment. It's about skills. It's about, you know, opportunities for business to do so. And that's where I think we need to put the emphasis.
So, yes. Alicia.
I'd like to, yes, very quickly.
Yeah,
I know
very
that
quickly.
We need to move to the next topic, but
yes.
I just want to say two things on this. First of all, again, from another planet, as you said, you know, Asia, dark by now. What if I read you this sentence? We need a common plan for digital Europe with clearly defined goals for 2030, such as for connectivity, skills, and digital public services. Sorry, what have we been doing until now? I mean, whoever reads this sentence will wonder why we don't have a strategy. And we actually do, but the point is, it sounds very defeating when you read it. And I'll go on personal data, business to consumer, Europe has been too slow and is now dependent on others. Gosh, can we change this? You know, because it ends there. The next sentence is, this shouldn't happen with industrial data, where, you know, we should find the way for Europe to lead since we have the industry. Well, first of all, the fact that we have the industry does not ensure we'll be leading digital services, or digital in general, for the industry. And second, there's nothing in the whole thing which kind of leads the way as to how we're going to do this. So in a way, it sounds very worrisome to me that we're still at this point, let alone, of course, the actual, you know, core of the issue of creating the technology ourselves. But even on the rollout of the technology, I worry, given what I just read, that it sounds like it's new to us, and of course it shouldn't be new to us. So it does, to me, as compared to green, going back to your question, for digital, it does sound a little bit desperate. I mean, we not only do we need to act fast, is that we're not sure which way to go, because we don't yet have, according to what I just read, strategy.
And on this note, I would like to point out the link exactly on what you're saying, Alicia, about the global scene, you know, which is highlighted by exactly this reflection that you just made, with the broader geopolitical theme that it was touched in the speech, because it's all interconnected, of course. I mean, like these three themes, the green stuff, the digital the digital part, and how Europe is presented and is related to the rest of the world, it's all connected, of course. And I'm especially looking at you, because there was a strong statement about China in the speech, just following the recent EU-China leader summit of earlier this week. It almost sounded like a continuation of the press conference that was delivered after the meeting a few days ago to me, in order to reiterate a certain position, like respond to the debate that was going on after this meeting, also in the press and in the political circles. So what do we make out of that part? I would like to start with you, Alicia, and the view on what she said about China, and then go a little bit broader, because of course she touched upon relations with the rest of the world and the US and Brexit and so on.
Well, thanks. I read the China part with great interest because, you know, the summit had just ended, and I just wanted to see how she was reflecting on the result of the summit, which was, as you all know, rather meager, to say the least, in terms of any decision whatsoever. And I think what I would highlight, first of all, is, you know, she did repeat the idea of a partner, but a competitor and a rival, and you know, two words rather than one for the more negative aspect of it. And then actually, rather than highlighting first the lack of market access and everything that relates to the ongoing negotiation with the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment, she started by the fact that China has not lived up to the commitments on the Paris Agreement. So green first, basically, which to me, and not a word on the ongoing negotiations, which to me sounds like, you know, this is not going to happen by the end of the year, which was what President Xi insisted upon during that summit. So green as an inevitable a force for cooperation with China. I mean, if we don't cooperate on green, we won't cooperate on anything else, because it's so necessary for everybody on this planet. So that's one. And then on this very thorny issues of Hong Kong and the Uyghurs, which both are mentioned in the speech, I think the very important sentence to me is that she basically argues that not that we are, our hands are tied because of our unanimity decision-making process. So she basically says that we absolutely need to move to qualified majority voting. And I think that's quite important, because she's the reason why she says that is really China and the shared values that we all have that can't be translated into action or statements even because of, you know, the lack of agreement of all of the parts, i.e. all of the European member states. So I think that's quite something. If you ask me, this was probably the part I liked the most, because it does show despair about how far we can go with our current institutional framework.
I see both André and Guntram nodding at you, Alicia, which is a promising sign of some comments to follow. Who wants to follow up on Alicia?
I mean, so perhaps I say one or two words. I mean, I think Alicia really, I very much agree with what Alicia said, which is not good for a podcast. But I think really the finger is exactly at the right points. I was also struck by you know, the clear statement on qualified majority voting. And of course, the big thing here is the European so-called European Magnitsky Act. Now, the Magnitsky Act is a US act where the United States has the power to sanction individuals or group of individuals because of human rights abuses. And, you know, sanction them financially, but also prevent them from entering US territory. And so Europe doesn't have that at the moment. And the statement that we want to introduce it is a big step. I sort of started asking around some lawyers, and, you know, some tell me that it might even be feasible to get something like this based on qualified majority voting. So in other words, once it's through, a qualified majority vote could actually be there to single out individuals and or groups of individuals and actually impose and sanction them for their human right abuses. And so that's a major new instrument, if it was to go through, a major new policy, foreign policy instrument for the European Union. And it shows that, you know, the European Union wants to be a geopolitical actor. And so in that sense, I think there it's really quite a strong push forward. But again, I think, as Alicia said, on the economic front, which is more sort of our expertise, I think basically what the speech says is we won't get a trade and investment agreement with China anytime soon. And I think she also mentioned, and I thought that was also important, the ongoing process in Europe to strengthen our economic instruments to protect our markets and ensure a level playing field. There's a big white paper by the Competition Policy Authority in Europe, and I think that instrument is an important instrument in our negotiations also vis-a-vis China. But overall, I think I think quite a consistent message, and certainly much more on the competition rivalry side than on the cooperation side vis-a-vis China, I would say.
I would like to ask André, moving from China, unless he really feels the urge to add something on the debate on China, of course, André, but I would like to follow up also on the other side of the world and her reference to the US and the, you know, this kind of declaration of Atlanticism, which came out of pretty straightforward and explicit, not so much as a surprise, but I think that what was the strong signal there was saying no matter who is going to sit in the White House, there is new beginnings with old friends that needs to be rebuilt. That were her own words. What do we make out of this also in this broader context that we are discussing here?
Okay, let me make two points, one more general and one specific on what you just said. The general is that I thought that this part, in a sense, naturally, this part, you know, the geopolitical part, Europe and the world, was the more presidential one, the one that fitted the best with sort of the presidential style. In a sense, when you start getting into the nitty-gritty of the green strategy or the digital, then, like my two colleagues, you know, you feel a little bit, you know, wanting for more detail. It's too much or too little. And as I said, to me, it was all right. But, you know, you can't sort of make a grand presidential speech talking about digital, you know, and the fact that we are lagging behind in digital and, you know, what levers can we pull here to do a better job. No, that's very different when it comes to the big Europe and the world. And, you know, that part is called a vital Europe in a fragile world. And I think it's a nice title, you know, Europe, that was the two previous parts. Europe has handled the COVID crisis quite well. You know, yes, we are pulling through together, as she said. And, you know, we are partners to the world. And, but there are problems, you know, the world out there is, she said, a fragile world. And, we have our values. Other countries have, different values. We have, some, difficult neighbors. And, you know, she names names and she talks about Turkey. She talks about Greece. And she talks about the UK and Ireland. I mean, she doesn't, you know, pull any punches. And then, yes, the China issue and the United States. On the United States, we are just before the election. So I think, in a sense, it's normal that she couldn't say much except that, you know, we have close ties, transatlantic ties. That's what she doesn't never use the word United States. She talks about transatlantic. And I think that was, again, right. She reaffirmed the fact that, you know, we have close ties with the United States, and she doesn't speak of NATO, but you know, that is in the subtext, and I think that is right, and that we are all in a sense waiting for what's going to happen in the US election. So I thought that part, in a sense, is the most presidential part and a nice part. And I think it showed that she was right, and corresponding to the issues of the day, to want to put geopolitics at the center of a mandate, because you know it is indeed a fragile world, and that has a lot of implication for Europe within our midst and for our relationship with other parts of the world, be they very close geographically or be they very, very far. So I think good messages there, and yes, a complicated, fragile world, I think, is a good notion.
I quite liked, if I can add, Giuseppe, the quote of Margaret Thatcher let me try to dig it out. I mean, the quote was saying the United Great Britain or the United Kingdom does not break laws, international laws, and that's not in the interest of the United Kingdom. I think that was, of course, a very strong, I mean, the precise quote, perhaps you can read it afterwards, but I think it was, of course, a very strong message that the withdrawal agreement that was signed is applicable international law, and you know, unilaterally going back on that one actually makes it impossible for the EU to negotiate much further with the UK. And I think this is a real issue, and it's a worrying issue. And I think she nicely also mentions the fact that, you know, on the other side of the channel, they are friends, right? They are all friends. They're not our enemies. They are our friends. And so we want to have a relation with them. But of course, it needs to be a relation based on trust and based on respecting treaties. I thought that was a very strong message.
Indeed. We are almost running out of time, and we have some questions from the audience as well, which I wanted to ask to you, especially now in this part of that focused on geopolitics. We have Arthur Maurer, who is asking that Turkey, is reflecting on the fact that Turkey was also specifically mentioned, and is asking if it is still a credible future member to the EU. Now, perhaps this goes even beyond the scope of this podcast, because we could have a full symposium about the issue. But maybe if we can reply to our listener at least on what kind of remarks the president did on that specific topic.
She mentioned the word Turkey or Turkish three times, Greece a couple of times. So it was clearly an important issue that she wanted to flag there, and I think she's right to do that. I think Europe is right to do this. I think our relationship with the Turkey is a very important relationship. I don't want to get into the details, and nobody of our listeners cares, you know, what is my view about whether Turkey should become a member or not of the European Union. I think it's a very complex issue, but I think what is clear is that the relationship between Europe and Turkey is really something very, very, very important for both sides. And I'm not looking at it only from, you know, the difficulties that we have at the moment. I'm looking at also at all the important things that we need to do together. Guntram just mentioned the fact that the UK is our friend, as an important partner. Well, we want also Turkey to be our friend and to be an important partner. Both the UK and Turkey, with different historical relationship to Europe and, you know, different parts, are both important neighbors of the European Union. And at some stage, obviously, Europe will need, with both of those partners, to design a relationship that is suitable for countries that are, you know, one has just left the EU, the other one is an applicant to the EU, but, you know, with a complicated relationship. And, you know, we can't escape geography and our history and the importance of those two partners.
I mean, perhaps if I can add to what André just said, I think, I mean, my reading of her take on the neighborhood is also, and, you know, neighborhood being UK, but also being Belarus, being Russia, but then also Turkey. I think the message is really one on, I mean, first of all, we insist on, you know, our sovereignty and our integrity, and we are fully behind all of our members of the EU. So strong message of support to Greece and Cyprus, but also, of course, in the Irish case, a strong support on Ireland. I think that's clearly the EU policy. First and foremost, it's about, you know, protecting the EU and protecting all of our member states fully. But then the message is, well, I mean, yes, we want a relation, but we want a relation based on good faith and respect of rules and respect of international treaties. I mean, that's basically the message. And in on Turkey, the message is, please, let's de-escalate, right? And you know, she welcomes the recent steps of pulling back the exploration ship that Turkey did back to the harbor of, I think, Antalya. So I think that's certainly a positive step. But, I mean, there can be no question about it that the EU stands fully behind all member states in protecting their rights and their sovereignty and our shared sovereignty, really.
I wanted to take a couple of more questions before we close, but very, very quickly. One is, perhaps we don't have the answers ourselves, but it's interesting to put it forward because it's one of the issues we haven't really discussed during our discussion so far. It's from Alan Franco from the radio and television from Switzerland. He's mentioning the fact that the president said something about a new strategy for Schengen, and Alan is saying that after a few phone calls, he is understanding that it is still in a very early stage, and he's asking if we know something more about it. Do we know anything more about it? Because this was like one of these new things that were just thrown over there and say, we're going to have a new strategy for Schengen. But I personally have no more information than what she mentioned in the speech. And I guess I see from your faces that you don't know either, but I felt it was interesting to put the question on the table because it was something new.
This happened.
And,
sorry,
and perhaps,
on that very, very quickly, yeah. I think I can understand the difficulties really in even figuring what she really meant, because right before that grand strategy on Schengen, she acknowledged that we must restore the four freedoms in full and as fast as possible. So basically anybody who reads that would be thinking that Schengen is going to go back to what it was, you know, in that sense. But the fact that she immediately after mentioned this new strategy makes me think and worry a little bit about that we might be thinking about something different in the light of what we learned during the pandemic. So is it good news or is it just a recognition that we might not be able to go back to the full freedom we had before? That's for me a little bit worrisome out of that new strategy for the future of Schengen. I thought that the future was secured by the fact that we want to restore that freedom. That, you see, so a little bit concerning to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think perhaps I can add, I think there is also a little bit of confusion here on this issue, really. I mean, Schengen is not the same as the four freedoms, right? I mean, the four freedoms are, I mean, if we take the labor movement of labor, it's about, you know, the right to work wherever you want. That's not the same as Schengen. Schengen is the right to cross the border without being controlled at the border. And the Schengen rules have a suspension clause that can be activated when national health is at risk. And these clauses were activated during the pandemic by a number of countries. And, you know, one can debate whether that was sensible or not. But, I mean, certainly there was a legal base for doing so. And the other big Schengen issue, I think, is, of course, related to migration. I mean, so you have immigrants coming into the Schengen area. And then, you know, as soon as they are inside, you know, they, in theory, they can, without border control, go to all other Schengen places. And that has, that is raising a lot of controversy. So I, like Alicia, I felt, I was a bit surprised that this Schengen point was mentioned right after the Four Freedoms. I think the Schengen issue is very much related at the moment, is very much related to the pandemic, and it's related to the migration issue. And on the migration issue, it's quite difficult at the moment, this discussion, as we are seeing with the refugees that were left homeless after the fire at the Moria camp in Lesbos. I mean, so we still do not have a proper strategy of, you know, how to deal with refugees and how to distribute them in the EU. And member states, I think, are still quite reluctant engaging in a joint strategy there.
Thank you, Guntram. Indeed, this this is all relates to this. It makes very much sense. And I'm afraid that we could continue this conversation for much longer, but we don't have any more time for this episode. So I would like to thank to you, all of you, to have joined the conversation. And I would like to thank our listeners for tuning in this live recording session of the first episode of the new season of the Sound of Economics Live. So this brings us to the end of these episodes, and I would like to remind to all of you that for more insight and research from our scholars, you can visit our website on www.bruegel.org. So until next time, bye bye.